Hello, your Hollywood reporter, Rockin' Ron, middays on 103.5 WGRR. Cincinnati's greatest hits, including playing your lunchtime greats by request between noon and 1. Got the latest issue of Entertainment Weekly. It's a double issue for October with Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon on the cover. And the title, Power Couple. Jen and Reese make news inside Apple's The Morning Show. The article written by Samantha Highfill. Stream Queens. Dawn of a new era inside fall's most anticipated series, Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon's The Morning Show, and the launch of Apple TV+. Reese Witherspoon isn't about to cause a scene, but she is freaking out a little bit. Diane Sawyer came to visit, and oh my God, it was amazing. Sitting in a Los Angeles restaurant on a balmy August evening, the Academy Award winner throws her hands over her face to muffle her excitement. She's recalling the day that the legendary broadcast journalist stopped by the set of her upcoming series with Jennifer Aniston called The Morning Show. First episode coming up November 1st. Her face is still in her hands. Witherspoon continues in disbelief. She sat at the monitor and watched me and Jen read the news. The pair have come a long way since trading barbs at Central Perk. The Morning Show, which marks Aniston's major return to TV after Friends ended in 2004, and the pair's first project together since Witherspoon guest-starred on the NBC comedy as Rachel's spoiled little sister Jill in the year 2000, takes viewers inside the world of daybreak news. There's something sort of bulletproof about morning shows, Witherspoon says. They're a stalwart part of American culture. After all, every day, millions of Americans wake up and turn on the Today Show, or any number of other programs, and are greeted by familiar faces they trust to deliver the news with just the right amount of personality. At least that's the expectation. As you brew your morning coffee, they update you on the latest from the White House. As you pick out your clothes for the day, they let you know how the weather is looking. And as you prepare to head out the door, they amuse you with fun anecdotes about the internet's buzziest viral video. These shows are some of the last programming in the country that still tries to appeal in Los Angeles and New York and Des Moines and Mississippi, says morning show executive producer Michael Ellenberg. You have to introduce an idea of what America is that works for blue states and red states. It was Ellenberg who brought the idea for the morning show to Witherspoon, whom he worked with on Big Little Lies, and Aniston in late 2016. I said to him, I'm not completely closed down to television because it's been pretty good, Aniston recalls. He can trace the idea back to 1989 when he saw Jane Pauley get replaced on Today. It's widely believed to be because she was too old. She was 39 at the time. Then in 2012, Today's veteran newsreader Ann Curry was reportedly driven off the program after less than a year as a co-host, a subject explored in journalist Brian Stettler's 2013 book called Top of the Morning, which Ellenberg quickly optioned. Stelter is a consulting producer on the show, which uses his book mostly for background research. These are some of the most powerful women in America, and we watch them get screwed publicly, basically, Ellenberg says. Witherspoon adds, I was astounded by how honest a lot of female anchors were with myself and Jen. I think most people would find it shocking that women in that position of what we perceive as power are looked at as expendable. With Aniston, age 50, and Witherspoon, 43 years of age, on board to star and executive produce the series, it wasn't hard to find the morning show a home. By August 2017, they'd met with Apple. Did we mention that Apple creates TV shows now? Earlier this year in March, the tech powerhouse announced it was entering the streaming world. Hey, all those cool kids are doing it. Joining the relative elders, Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon Prime Video, as well as the new class of streamers, HBO Max, Disney Plus, Facebook Watch, Snap Originals, and too many more to count. Apple is launching Apple TV Plus. It's an app so shrouded in secrecy you'd think it was the nuclear codes or the next iPhone. For instance, details of the service are still to be announced, but at press time, Apple wouldn't even confirm how much it will cost. But the Apple execs do have jokes, promising to reveal how much it will cost if only a reporter would hand over her credit card information. One thing that's always been known is that The Morning Show would be part of Apple TV Plus's initial slate of programming. It was day two or three of us being here at Apple when we heard the pitch, says Jamie Ehrlich, who is head of worldwide video for Apple, alongside Zach Van Amberg. Both came over from Sony Pictures Television. It was so undeniable, both in the story they wanted to tell and who was involved. We left the meeting and we literally didn't even know how to order paper clips for the office, let alone a TV series. But we said we had to have it. 15 minutes later, they called to make an offer, and it seems the enthusiasm was mutual. The more ambitious this project was, the more I felt like Apple was the right place for it, because they were taking a shot too, Witherspoon says. They're putting themselves out there to get into the content world. It also probably didn't hurt that Apple agreed to pick up the series for 2 10-episode seasons before they'd filmed anything. But the show Apple was originally pitched isn't exactly what made it to the screen. We started developing it in August, and by November, the whole world had changed, says Witherspoon, specifically the hashtag MeToo movement. On October 5th of 2017, the New York Times published a piece in which Ashley Judd, among others, accused film mogul Harvey Weinstein of sexual harassment. On October 15th, Alyssa Milano invited other women to speak out by tweeting MeToo, a movement originated by Tarana Burke in 2006. By the end of November, accusations had come out about Kevin Spacey, Louis C.K., and even today's Matt Lauer. On November 29th, NBC fired their co-host of 2 decades following allegations of sexual misconduct. When the hashtag MeToo movement happened, it's like we can't not address it, Aniston says, with Witherspoon adding, I don't think I've seen a time in my life where more people have lost their entire careers over misconduct. People who were seemingly untouchable. We had to start totally over and redevelop the show, but it actually turned out to be so much more potent and topical. Part of that redevelopment process involved a showrunner swap. In April of 2018, Carrie Aaron replaced House of Cards' Jay Carson, who'd previously been attached to the project. We realized that the story that was unfolding was not the story we all wanted to tell, said Ehrlich. So we regrouped with the exec producing team, and we realized that as fantastic as Jay is, we just saw a different vision for this particular show, and that's where Carrie came into the picture. Aaron, who'd written for Friday Night Lights and Parenthood and co-created Bates Motel, came to the series ready to tackle the hashtag MeToo of it all as well as tell a story through the female lens. I love broadcast news, and I love network, so it feels like an area where you can have a lot of humor, but you can also get at some real subjects, Aaron says. I've been a woman in a very high-stakes business for 30 years, and I've seen all kinds of stuff. I wanted to write complicated female characters that weren't perfect and that weren't witches. Those complicated female characters include Aniston, as longtime morning show co-host Alex Levy, and Witherspoon, sporting brown hair and a southern accent, as West Virginia local news reporter Bradley Jackson. Levy is a seasoned anchor, a well-oiled machine. She wakes up every morning at 3:30, works out, grabs her Red Bull and coffee, and prepares to give America whatever it needs that day. Jackson is a bit of a hothead. She's dangerously passionate about the truth, and from time to time that passion gets her into trouble. But neither woman is prepared for what their lives are about to become when the series begins. In the show's pilot, the sun's not even up in New York City when the hits the fan. After 15 years of co-hosting alongside Alex Levy, Mitch Kessler, played by Steve Carell, has been fired following allegations of sexual misconduct. And it's Levy who has to go on camera and address the nation just mere hours after finding out the news herself. Sound familiar? Matt Lauer won't think this has anything to do with him, Aniston says sarcastically. And although Aaron would like to remind everyone that the morning show is a work of fiction, this is the world we live in right now, and it's impossible to ignore it. If there's one thing this show doesn't do, it's ignore it. People don't look the other way anymore, director and executive producer Mimi Letter says. We put a microscope right up to who these people are. That includes the accused, Mitch, who, like Carell himself, is a man America has fallen in love with and is one of the last men they want to see accused of something bad. As Aniston puts it, no one else could play that part. There's nothing you could find out about Steve in a closet. And for Carell, the man best known for playing hilariously incompetent boss Michael Scott on The Office for 6 years, it was a chance to play a guy who refuses to take a long, hard look in the mirror. Mitch is a very flawed human being and someone with enormous personal blind spots, Carell says. But Mitch's firing is just the beginning of the most in-depth exploration of hashtag MeToo scripted television has seen thus far. What happens to the accuser? What happens to the accused? How are loved ones affected? Sometimes the world is so confusing, the only way that you can understand it is through art, Witherspoon says. We don't take sides in any of it. It's about the humanity of these issues. As for Witherspoon's Bradley, she finds herself in Alex's orbit when a video of her arguing with a coal mine protester goes viral and the morning show producers bring her on for an interview. We can't quite get into where the two women go from there, but with everything that's going on, Bradley is not Alex's biggest concern. Because not only has Alex lost her partner, but her contract is up for renegotiation with the network, led by slippery man-in-charge Corey Ellison, played to perfection by Billy Crudup. And let's just say that she's older than Jane Pauley was in 1989. As Alex tells her teenage daughter in episode 3, sometimes women can't ask for control, so they have to take it. Back in Los Angeles, just hours before Witherspoon will get lost in her memory of Diane Sawyer's set visit, Aniston is sitting poolside at her sleek hilltop home, holding a bottle of smart water, like the dedicated spokeswoman she is. Her blue eyes still sparkle the same way they did when she first walked onto the Friends soundstage. But by now, they've seen some things. "This role never could have come to me any sooner than now," she says. "It's one of the hardest jobs I've had. I knew I was up to the task, but then there was the excavation of all the emotions in order to create this world for this woman. All of her lifelines are falling away. I would walk out of some of those scenes feeling like a manhole cover just came off of my back." Because, much in the way that America feels like it knows Alex Levy within the world of the morning show, America feels like it knows Jennifer Aniston in real life. "I understand that, with people having connections to Friends," Aniston says. "I understand the isolation, not wanting to be seen, not wanting to be public, and not wanting to have to go on a red carpet. It's not always easy to go out there and have to be the person that you have to be. But when the lights come on and the cameras are pointed at you, you just figure it out. Especially if Diane Sawyer is watching." And with the cover story in mind, Editor's Notes, written by J.D. Heyman, A New Golden Age. Every TV addict has a love story. Here's part of mine. TV, when I was wee, was not a distribution platform, but an actual box which adults banished to its proscribed space, where it could be watched after dinner. The box brought you the family hour, the buddy cop hour, and the Nolan Miller hour, when heiresses fell down staircases to induce miscarriage. Most everybody believed the box turned kids into idiots. So naturally, I fell hard for TV. Not for the sliver of it that passed muster with my parents, like Masterpiece Theater, but for the loud jiggly brought to you by Aaron Spelling kind. It seduced me, surely as it did Heather O'Rourke in Poltergeist, and swept me off to corrupting places. Now all that seems quaint. Sophisticated adults today, let's start with you, love TV the way my folks love Charles Mingus and Vantage 100s. Yes, there's still loads of dreck, but what's great is sublime and plentiful. So much so that the screenwriter John Gaddins likes to joke that he's binging Knife's Edge or the Poconos to see if people believe him. He invents shows to make the point that there's way too much good stuff to keep track of. The TV expertly curated in this issue is peak. Florence and the Renaissance, the main event. It's where the hottest talent wants to be. The women on our cover, two of the biggest stars of any generation, doing some of their best work on Apple TV Plus on the morning show, are part of a tectonic shift. Television has burst out of its box, becoming storytelling undammed. The medium is evolving at such a dizzying pace. Broadcast, cable, streaming, quick bite, that it can be hard to describe it, let alone keep track of menu options on your screen. Fear not, we're from Pop Culture Headquarters and we're here to help. I wouldn't trade this era for any other. But every so often, I do yearn for the days when TV was our sketchy little hearth, connecting us to a few things, all at the exact same time. Missed it? Well, wait for summer reruns. There's a story Tina Fey tells that makes my heart clench, about being a kid on Saturday nights, sipping cream soda out of a champagne glass and wearing her mom's caftan so she could pretend that she was on the Lido deck when the Love Boat aired. Yeah, it was dumb, but it was magic. All of us lonely kids glued to the box. It held us close, linked us together, and in its lovable, tacky way, made us a bit more whole. Next up in the latest issue of Entertainment Weekly magazine, The Must List. The top 10 things we love this month. At number 10, it's music with Brittany Howard. The mighty voice Alabama Shakes front woman confidently steps out on her own with an expansive righteous manifesto disguised as a solo debut. Named for her older sister, who passed away as a teenager, Jamie is deeply personal, yet emotionally universal, as Howard explores the different colors within her vocal range, often deploying a mesmerizingly hazy head voice over dreamy instrumentation. With help from collaborators like Shake's mate Zach Cockrell and Robert Glasper, Howard tackles love, joy, anger, community, race, intimacy, and more with a force that will leave you feeling less alone. The Must List continues with number 9, Movies Zombieland Double Tap. Audiences first ventured into Zombieland's comic apocalyptic playground in 2009, back when Woody Harrelson was still pre-True Detective, Jesse Eisenberg was pre-Social Network, and Emma Stone was pre-a freaking Oscar. A decade later, the gods of Hollywood scheduling have smiled upon these busy A-listers and freed them up to make a smart, campy, zombie-blasting zinger of a follow-up out October 18th, with Zoe Deutsch, Rosario Dawson, and Luke Wilson joining the gang to battle the undead. Double Tap makes one heck of a case for the merits of unexpected sequels, and an even better argument for never ever taking a group vacation. Up next on Entertainment Weekly's The Must List for October, number 8 is TV, Buried Treasures, the best stuff you totally missed, Peaky Blinders. One of the earliest questions every baby Netflix user learns to ask is, what the heck is Peaky Blinders? Turns out, everyone's favorite ubiquitous algorithmic recommendation refers to an exquisitely suspenseful period thriller about a British street gang turned global family empire. Sort of a curious cross between the gangs of New York and the Crown, if Queen Elizabeth were played by Cillian Murphy and her corgis were gypsies and hookers. Season 5, streaming now, is already off to a rollicking start, throwing the band of brothers and Aunt Polly into a world turned upside down by the American stock market crash. Still, you can consider Peaky Blinders a more than sound investment of your precious time. At number 7 on the must list, books. Find Me by Andre Aciman. Aciman's moving Call Me By Your Name sequel may flash decades forward, but it's still just as lush, languid, and erotic as the beloved original. Here you'll find your middle-aged ennui and cross-continental voyages placed alongside the more familiar pleasures of intellectual repartee, meditations on true love, and very vivid descriptions of fresh fruit. Find Me builds toward the Call Me By Your Name epilogue, which does not appear in the 2017 film, by the way, wherein Elio and Oliver, kept apart for decades, reunite and reflect on their time together, and from there, find satisfying closure. Are the pair destined to be together? And perhaps more important, is it still peach season? This article written by David Canfield. Total Recall. Here's where we re-meet Find Me's three narrators. There's Elio, just 17 years old in Call Me By Your Name. Elio has since made good on his music potential, thriving as a classical pianist in Paris. He's also in a new romance with an older man. Safe to say, however, he's no Armie Hammer. There's Oliver. As expected, Oliver is a married father back in the U.S., working as a professor, but he still pines for Elio. Is domesticity really any contest for a torrid summer affair? And decides to go looking for him. And then there's Samuel, Elio's father, Dr. Perlman, whose final act speech in Call Me By Your Name marks one of the story's highlights. Gets a larger role in the sequel when he meets a woman and becomes infatuated while on his way to visit his son. We're up to number 6 in Entertainment Weekly's must list for October. It's music, The High Women. Like with many groups deemed worthy of the super moniker over the years, one of the most beguiling aspects of the eponymous debut album from The High Women, the supergroup comprising Natalie Hemby, age 42, Maren Morris, 29, Brandi Carlile, 38, and Amanda Shires, 37, is the quartet's goosebump-inducing harmonies. As solo singer-songwriters, the women are formidable, but together, they are sublime. Part of what makes the punch of the High Women's harmony so potent is when they transition from singing the same notes in unison, like the gorgeous segue on Crowded Table, one of a dozen songs steeped in classic country and Americana. When I look back on it, it was all really natural, but in a mystical way, says the Grammy-winning Carlile, who cooked up the group concept with Shires and then brought in Morris and Hemby into the fold. A host of other well-respected names support the High Women on the album, among them Carlile's bandmates, Tim and Phil Hannisroth, Shire's husband, Jason Isbell, producer Dave Cobb, and singers Yola and Sheryl Crow. For Carlile, the record was deeply personal, particularly Crowded Table, which she co-wrote with Hemby and singer-songwriter Laurie McKenna. The ballad helped her articulate a concept she had long wrestled with, of being an individual inside a community, of going out into the world and being an activist, but still being able to come home at the end of the day and be in my family with people that do not agree with me, so that we can all move a little bit closer to the middle of the road. She realized that almost unwittingly, the vocal arrangements of certain high women songs mirrored that concept. Even within our band, we do not all believe the same things, said Carlile. But to snap those voices back into unison like that is really what the concept of women learning to work together in community is. The High Women have already proved themselves a force, playing the Newport Folk Festival this past July and welcoming none other than Dolly Parton, no stranger to supergroups, given her beloved Trio records with Linda Ronstadt and Emmylou Harris, to the stage as a special guest. I felt like I was having an out-of-body experience, as Hemby, a longtime writer of Nashville hits, now getting her own time in the spotlight. I was just like, there's Dolly Parton. This is Dolly Parton. She's right in front of me. And of course, Hemby already knows the women who've got her back. This article written by Sarah Rodman. We're at the halfway point of the must list from Entertainment Weekly magazine. At number 5, it's podcast tabloid, The Making of Ivanka Trump. Before nepotism made her the unlikeliest presidential advisor, Ivanka Trump was best known as an aspiring socialite who played a business lady on The Apprentice. Vanessa Gregorius, a sharp Manhattan writer who's observed the rich with a jaundiced eye for years, delivers the Ivanka origin story in a luminary podcast. We go deep with the heiress, once a chipmunk cheap daddy's girl, now reconstructed as a femboatized deliverer of lean and cliches. No stranger to the gilded precincts that spawned our heroine, Gregorius shows us that money can buy you many things, but gravitas isn't one of them. At number 4 on the must list, games. Luigi's Mansion 3. He's played second fiddle to an icon since 1983, but Luigi, the green-cap brother of Nintendo superstar Mario, gets top billing in his own standalone series. The third installment of the Mansion games, in which Luigi solves paranormal puzzles in a spooky manner, arrives just in time for Halloween. Armed with a ghost-sucking vacuum and an oozy doppelganger named Guigi, Luigi's otherworldly adventure delivers when it comes to gameplay and humor. And if he be forever in Mario's shadow, well, at least Luigi got a mansion out of it. Bromance, the secret history of Luigi. You know, Luigi is a living hand-me-down. Because of tech limitations on the original game, Nintendo had to model its second character after Mario. The green? Well, recycled from Turtles. Mario stole Luigi's career. Mario was a carpenter until his plumbing bro arrived in 1983, and then Mario switched jobs. Luigi has a vice. Super Mario 64 DS and New Super Mario Brothers are recommended for kids older than 12 because Luigi introduces impressionable tots to gambling. Luigi is musical. Gaming's ultimate second fiddle masterfully plays an actual violin in WarioWare Smooth Moves. And Luigi may be illiterate. A set of 90s flashcards features him holding a magazine upside down, suggesting that for all his skills, Luigi can't read. We're up to number 3 on the must list. It's books, The Testaments, written by Margaret Atwood. 34 years after her startling, prescient novel, The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood delivers a potent sequel sure to supercharge political debate. Arriving in the prime Trump era, The Testaments reads like feminist wish fulfillment as the woman-hating, fundamentalist country of Gilead heads for a much-deserved fall, orchestrated from deep within its cloistered center of power. It's a revolution many in real life hope for, and that's exactly what the 79-year-old Booker Prize winner intends. One of the questions left open by The Handmaid's Tale is how Gilead ends. You answer that in The Testaments. What was the real-life inspiration? Margaret Atwood says, regimes end either because they're undermined from within or because they run out of steam. They fail to deliver on whatever paradise or utopia was promised. New generations come along, and they are not the fervent, true believers that the people who set it up may have been. You've seen this enacted before your very eyes. The Handmaid's Tale predated the Trump administration, but it's hard not to draw parallels to American politics. Atwood replies, you know, Madeleine Albright has just come out with a book called Fascism, A Warning. And you can go into that book and read about all different kinds of fascism. There's lots of models, big and small, but one thing these totalitarian regimes have in common is they all want to roll back women's rights. There are no exceptions to that. How does the sequel fit into the universe of the pending fourth season of Hulu's TV series of Handmaids? Margaret Atwood says, what I have given them in the locked writer's room that nobody's allowed into, including me, is a whole new whiteboard and a bunch of new characters. The story of the characters in the show at the moment is left open, so it's up to showrunner Bruce Miller and the highly competent writing team as to how they get those people into position. And finally, you leave a few things open to speculation in the conclusion of the Testaments. What theories do you think readers will have? Atwood responds, I never try to second-guess readers, and I think it's mean for the author to fill everything in. Why should I be the absolutely infallible authority on anything? The other thing about a book is, it's got these things called covers. And if you don't like the book, you can close them. Nobody's making you read this, except for people with jobs like yours. Staying with books at number two on the must list, Dear Girls, Intimate Tales, Untold Secrets, and Advice for Living Your Best Life by Ali Wong. Comedian Ali Wong's new book, a collection of letters to her two young daughters, is fierce, feminist, and packed with funny anecdotes. Here's just a peek. I was on my way to a San Diego show in Friday afternoon traffic from Los Angeles. Mari and Grandma were in the car with me. I was in gridlock traffic, and there was no end in sight. I was driving, and I had to pee so bad. I finally told Grandma, grab me one of Mari's diapers. It was a size 3 diaper, so it was destined to hold the pee of a human under 20 pounds. Well, I shoved the diaper in my underwear and peed into it. The diaper filled up within 2 seconds. Then I told Grandma to grab me another diaper. And another. And another. Mari, I peed into 5 of your diapers and felt a huge sense of victory. Pimp of the Year by Drew Down happened to start playing on the radio. I threw up my arms. It's okay. Like I said, I was stuck in traffic, so it was perfectly safe to take my hands off the steering wheel to celebrate. And screamed, woo! While my mom was laughing. I had hacked this problem. I was the wolf from Pulp Fiction. I finally understood what they meant by having it all. Again, that's from Dear Girls by comedian Ali Wong. And what was number one for the month of October in Entertainment Weekly's must list? You'll find out next time. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day. I'm Rockin' Ron Schumacher, your Hollywood reporter from 103.5 WGRR, Cincinnati's greatest hits.